who are you really? When you strip down everything you can think to strip down in a Cartesian dumping all the apples out of the basket sense, what's left? Hey y'all, I'm Reese, and welcome to Making Meaning. Making Meaning is a podcast by the Cohere Collective here to help guide you along your path to make meaning in a way that makes sense for you. This week, I am joined by Jules Kuroda, and Jules is the author of The Innate Self, spelt in and the number 8. And that's what we talk about in this episode. What is the innate self? If you truly could strip away culture, socialization, genetics, identity, your name, personality, what are you? But then those other pieces are vital to the puzzle of who we are too. And so as we build these pieces back in, how do they inform us about who we are? About what it means to be a human being. Yes, there is something innate inside of us, but there is also this version of ourself that is experiencing life right now in this body, in this iteration, whatever your worldview or bigger belief system about the mystery of what's going on here is. We are here. And what does that tell us about who we are? I love this episode. Obviously, I love all these episodes. It's my favorite thing in the world to get to sit and talk and ask the questions you're not supposed to ask at dinner parties to people. But this one, really, we get into some really important stuff in terms of the intersection between the mystery, spiritual, kind of scientific questions about what's going on here and how that really importantly overlaps with things like justice and ethics and relationships and the way that we want to live in our day-to-day life. And I think so often we see people really, really emphasizing one camp or the other, and we need to be having this conversation about bridging both, about how we are divine beings having an earthly experience, but that this earthly experience matters too, because we're here and your life matters. So Jules's book, The Innate Self, will be down in the description box wherever you are listening or watching to check out. I highly recommend you do. She proposes a system for understanding what the self is that I think is really helpful, especially if you've never asked these questions before. She offers entry points no matter where you may fall. If you're deeply spiritual or religious, there's an entry point for you. If you're deeply justice and ethics-based, there's an entry point for you. If you're deeply scientific, there's an entry point for you. And I think that that's really important when we ask these questions, is to meet people where they are, to meet yourself where you are, to be able to enter into this conversation in a way that feels honoring of the way you approach the question. If we're going to ask questions together, we all get to ask the question in our own language, right? But also, how can we learn the language that other people speak in the way that they ask the question? And I think that's what Jules's work allows us to begin to do. I think that is all I have for you here in the intro. Get into it. It's a juicy one, and I hope you enjoy. So, as always, let's take a deep breath. And get started. Jules, thank you so very much for the time and energy of meeting with me today. I am so excited to dive into the innate self and your work, your life, your story. So thank you very, very much.
Well, thanks so much, Reese, for having me on. It's always a pleasure to get to connect with people.
Absolutely. Well, to get us started, the question I always like to start with, just to hopefully set a good expansive tone for the podcast, is what is one thing you're grateful for right now?
Ooh, great question. Today, I'm grateful for my health. Last weekend, I went with one of my best friends and we did a 30-mile hike in the Appalachian Trail. And it was one of those, like, you just carry everything on your back, you know, and schlep it up the mountain. And I was like, yeah, I still got it. So it really made me feel very grateful for my physical health.
Absolutely. That's so impressive. My knee is aching just thinking about it. But okay,
mine
so I have
too.
Right. How long did it end up taking y'all? 30 miles.
Well, we did. So the first day we actually got rained out. So we did like 4 miles in like soaking rain. And then we were like, well, let's start over again tomorrow. And so then we did the next like 20, 23 miles the next day. And then we just ended with a,
wow.
So it just took a couple of days, but you know, you don't do it continuously. You like stop
right.
And pitch a tent and yeah.
Absolutely. Great. Did you see any Mothman or other cryptids while you were there?
Nope, nothing like that. Just some beautiful trees.
Amazing. I love it. Well, my second question for you is, what is your story? Of course, that's a really big question. And you have also written a book that incorporates a lot of your story into it. But whatever you're called to share about your story in this moment, I would love to hear what you have to share.
Sure. So I was raised in the Midwest, and I have had the pleasure at this point of living all over this country. And I've also had the opportunity of living in Africa for a little bit, of living in Europe for a little bit, and living in Canada. So I feel like I've gotten a really great kind of understanding of commonalities and differences of culture, but that common human thread that connects through regardless of the differences in culture. Growing up in the Midwest, you know, I definitely have had my horse riding days, my mud schlepping days. But I also lived in LA. We were those crazy people during the pandemic that moved out of LA and got an RV and lived in the national parks for a couple of years. And that was just incredible. Not continuously, but as much as we can stand it. We did, you know, 30 days here and there. And it was a really great opportunity, actually, to see like the majesty of nature. It really made a profound impact on me. And I've had multiple chapters in my life, I would say. Like I've had, you know, professionally speaking, I started out in academia. I'm an educator by nature, by heart. Did 10 years there, moved over into the nonprofit space, which was a really incredible experience, kind of on like deeply emotional level of connecting with people and seeing. I worked largely with the refugee community, which I do talk quite a bit about in the book. And it really, really made a huge difference on my life. And during that time, after that, I moved into working in an orphanage in Liberia for a little while. For a nonprofit in the US. And that was a pivotal moment for me in understanding that I didn't have some of the tools I wanted to be able to influence and tell good stories. And so it sent me back to school. That's when I moved out to LA, got my master's in organizational leadership, and then turned the corner and went into corporate and started coaching executives. And so I've had a varied journey, and I like to think about my life in chapters. So the book is a totally new chapter for me of actually putting something out into the world, which is both thrilling and a little scary.
Yeah, absolutely. The excitement, fear of all of that, right? I love what you said about getting to experience all of these different facets of humanity and the human experience from all the different places that you've been able to live and all the different communities that you've been able to be a part of and learn from. With that common human thread, this is really the crux of the book. So I kind of want to dive into it. Talk to me about how you conceptualize of this common human thread. And why are you so fascinated by it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, to talk about how I conceptualize it, it almost feels to me more like a river, or like there's a flow of energy that happens between us. And not to sound so, you know, esoteric about it, but I think we step into it most often in moments where we're kind of silent, or we're not bound by language. This has been my experience in working with so many different people that I couldn't communicate with. And in spite of not being able to actually like mentally connect through, you know, ideas and language, we were still able to have these beautiful moments of connection. And that to me is stepping into that shared thread. And I talk a little bit in the book about my neighbor Rangina, but when I moved to LA, I was living in a little studio apartment, and my neighbor across the way, she was Afghani, couldn't speak almost any English. I mean, she just was like, hello. And she could say, she'd say hello and come over here. But it was just come, you know? And during, you know, that time that I lived there, I had dinner with her probably three nights a week. And we would just sit in like this beautiful silence where she's prepared a meal for me. And you could feel the generosity and the kindness and the warmth and the connection without any language. And that to me is kind of the heart of what it means to step into that thread of human connection. Is it's very accessible, but sometimes we almost mentally block it. But if you take away the mental things like language and ideas, and actually just have shared experiences, it's really hard to deny.
Yeah. Absolutely. With taking out this mental piece of the picture, right? Because of course, one of the parts of the book that I really love is how you do integrate the esoteric with some of these more grounded academic concepts. And you mentioned earlier, you're an academic by trade, you're a teacher. And bridging the gap between these kind of I don't really like the phrase New Age because I think so much of it is actually about returning to ancient and indigenous practices. But for lack of a better term, New Age and kind of metaphysical practices with grounded scientific practices. Can you talk to me about why it is in this intersection between like kind of removing the language, linguistic, descriptive, maybe more structured academic sense of experience? Why is that where this sense of humanness arises? And yet we're still kind of bound by our brain, right? And being within that. So yeah, talk to me a little bit about that liminality and why that's where you see, you feel, and you see this experience arise.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking a really good expansive question. So let me break it down in terms of how I see it, and I'm going to use my coaching frameworks for this. So, you know, the way that we tend to think about ourselves, and I'll speak from a Western culture perspective, is we see ourselves as sort of our mind, which we know through our language, our ideas, our bodies, which is all about like our action and ability to actually like do things, and our hearts. So that's all about our emotions. But outside of all of those things, that we have these characteristics in us that long for meaning and purpose and joy and contribution. And how do you explain what courage is and our need for creativity, all these things that don't fit into those buckets. And that's because, in my opinion, there's a fourth aspect of us that we don't conceptualize as so much. And that's what I call the innate self, or the spiritual self. But I intentionally wanted to create new language around it because I think people sort of fall into one or two camps around the ideas of spirituality. They're either like totally bought in and they have a belief system and or a practice, or they don't. And because they may be more analytical, and I've worked with a lot of highly analytical people who are like, well, I don't know what my belief system is, so I don't think I'm spiritual. And I want to break that down. Like we have four aspects of us: our mind, our heart, our body, and our spirit. And that spirit is the being part. And so you ask, like, why is it outside of sort of language and constructs that we tap into that? It's because it is being. It is when we are in nature. We connect with these moments, right? When you're in nature and you just quiet your mind a little bit, or through mindful practice, you know, there's a lot of research on that. Just the sense of feeling connected to something bigger than yourself, connecting to one another, it sits in that space outside of mind. And I think that's so hard for us in our culture, in Western culture particularly, because we're so attached to mind.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's important just to kind of push against it a little bit, just to create a little space to see and or feel something maybe a little different.
Yeah, totally. I completely agree that it is so hard for us to kind of, it's almost like let go to step into it, right? That in, like you said at the very beginning of that answer, from this Western framework, right? I think there is something very Western about stepping into the analytical mind and like, okay, but how do I understand this? Can I put together a philosophical proof of all of the things? And yet you can't categorize or describe these certain things. What is it, in your opinion, that draws us? Because like you said, we have this innate drive towards meaning and purpose and the big, big questions, the mystery, as I like to call it. What is it that, I guess I'll ask a twofold question, drives us towards that and that curiosity, but also keeps us in wanting to analyze and explain it and not just allowing it to be mysterious?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are in and of ourselves an ecosystem, right? We're like a whole integrated being. And so emotions are even kind of hard to detangle from our thoughts and definitely from our bodies. It all coexists, and yet there are distinctions. And I think that is a part of what my hope is, that we can understand sort of the distinction of our innate self, which just the innate stands for like our higher nature that has eight characteristics, but it's also innate in all of us. And regardless of culture or any of that, it's just like a human, it's the divinity in us, right? And so I think there's something really powerful about recognizing that, but also, yeah, we need to understand things. Like, that's also how we're programmed. And I think, you know, to me, the power of understanding how our minds work from more of a holistic lens is to recognize, like, our minds naturally are trying to protect us. Like, that's what they do. I mean, they are there to help make sure that they're like incredible tools, but they can wield power for us or against us. And that is just a hard thing to reconcile. And I talk a lot about the mind in the beginning, just around, like, I think I call it our frenemy, because I think it unlocks so many things for us. And the power of our thinking, you know, it really creates a lot of our world. But it's like a pair of glasses that you can't take off. And just because you see something a particular way doesn't mean that's how it is. And so I think the more we can understand some of the limitations of the mind, we can create some space to experience something outside of it. And that's my hope, because I do feel like, to your question around, I feel like we are drawn towards meaning and purpose. And it's interesting, I talked a little bit about this, just in terms of working with executives. You know, one of the things that was so powerful to me and part of what led me to write this book is that at the end of these, you know, conversations with executives who were talking about, how do I make my team more impactful? How do I be more impactful? Productivity, productivity, productivity. There would become this moment, if we worked together long enough, where they would start to say, but I just don't know what it means, or I just don't know what, if I'm actually making a difference in the world, or am I really helping people? Or I feel like I have so much more to offer, and I just don't feel like I'm able to do it. And there were these deep personal questions that people wanna, if they allow themselves to go there, want to answer. But I think we hold ourselves back sometimes from it because we're afraid of where it might lead us. And that's the mind trying to protect us, right? So I think we do have an internal compass. And that's the way I think of the innate self, is it's our compass. If we tap into it, and it will lead us towards things that we feel called in, and to use our gifts and to use our talents. But it's that small, quiet voice. It's not the one that's super loud in our brains. As I talk about our internal roommates that live in our mind, it's not there.
Hey, y'all, it's Reese interrupting our conversation briefly just to ask you if you're enjoying it. Check in, see how it's going. And if you are enjoying it, please consider liking, subscribing, leave us a 5-star rating or review, or drop us a comment down below with your thoughts and reactions. Wherever you are listening or watching, that is the best way to let us know that you're enjoying this, that you want to see more content like this, and let me know that it means something to you or sparked something for you. I also try to engage in conversation in the comments as much as possible. So if you have any thoughts, I would love to hear them and chat with you more about it down below. Okay, back to the conversation.
Yeah, I love the frenemy comparison because it is so, it's both our gateway into understanding, but also the thing that keeps us from being able to be within the whole. And that's something you talk about, like the individual versus the universal, right? And how having a self is the thing that allows you to experience it all, but it's also the thing that prevents you from being in the universal innateness of it all. You said something that I think is so fascinating and I agree with, in that it is our mind trying to protect us. And I think, I mean, we all, with all of the beautiful new research that's coming out around psychology and how anxiety and all sorts of different, you know, mental experiences that we have. I say anxiety because it's closest for me to grab onto, right? But it's actually a holdover from back in the day needing to protect ourselves truly physically. And now it's this new kind of protection that we work beyond and past. What is it that you think our minds are trying to protect us from now? Because I do think for me, anytime I step into, I'll use your beautiful language, the innate self, and I feel that alignment with the universal, or, you know, some sort of spiritual spark, or just the breadth and depth of the mystery, it feels like a homecoming. It doesn't feel scary. And yet the mind is protecting us. Mm-hmm. What's it protecting us from?
It's such a great and loaded question. And, you know, part of the reason I talk about the mind as the frenemy and that we have these internal roommates is it shows up with different voices to protect us from different things. The bottom line, I would say, is it's trying to protect us from what perceived danger. But what's interesting about the world that we live in today is that perceived danger could be reputational. It could be like, I don't want to say something that makes me sound stupid because I don't want people to think of me that way. Like, that's a thing our mind tries to protect us from. Our mind's trying to protect us from being gullible. And I think I talk a little bit about how I think, you know, culturally, we've gotten into a pattern where it may be easier for us to not believe something than to believe something. And I think that I don't want to be caught gullible. I don't want to be perceived and I don't want the gotcha moment. And so I'm not going to believe in the mystery. I'm going to believe in the things I know and the things I understand and the things that are proven. And it's understandable. It's just very limiting, I think, to think that it's all that you have to know everything in order for it to be true. And that's the part I feel like, you know, if you step into nature, nature's a beautiful example to me because we're still discovering so much. Like, there are still so many species of things we do not know. And there is a beautiful thinker, and she does really great work in biomimicry called Janine Benyus. And what she does is she essentially looks at how natural things work in the world and then helps organizations figure out how to work parroting what's happening in nature. And what's really interesting, if you look into the research, is like, nature is so interconnected. I mean, like, even the way that tree roots work, they're all interconnected and they send each other signals. And so like, if one tree gets sick or if there's a fire that's coming, they literally send each other signals through their root system. And it's just really powerful. But we didn't know that until like, not very long ago. So there's like all these mysteries that if we expect that we know them and knowing them means that they're true, we miss out on so much of what life has to offer. And I think nature is such a beautiful example of life's mysteries that we can learn from if we tap in and remind ourselves that in some ways the world knows so much more than we do. Like creation has, it's so masterfully made, and it has so much to teach us, but we have to put ourselves in a receptive mode and lower some of that barrier of that, the mental rigor we try to put around understanding everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And just be and allow and feel. Yeah, absolutely. With that and this framework that you offer with kind of the four distinctions here of selfhood, one of my questions was the way that these four segments of mind, heart, body, and innate self interact. Do you view the innate self as kind of the umbrella over these other pieces from which everything stems? Are these all like equal puzzle pieces? Or is there something more primordial in the innate self that is kind of originary? That's not a word, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, and how these, and you mentioned earlier, they intersect and they're constantly, you know, bumping up against each other. But yeah, talk to me a little bit about why they are distinct and the places where those distinctions get a little fuzzy.
Yeah. So I'll use an analogy, because I think of the self and its component parts kind of like an orchestra. So you've got like all these different instruments that come together. And you have the role of the conductor, and then you have the role of the person who's actually like written the music, the composer. And they all play different parts, but they come together super fluidly. And so I think about the body in this analogy is the actual instruments. It's right, literally playing the music. And then you have the composer, and the composer is the brain, and how it's actually putting things together, right? And then you have the heart is sort of the emotionality that comes in through the music and the signaling. And then I think of the innate self as more of that orchestra leader, the one who is conducting, who is saying, it's time for you to go. It's time for you to go. If we tap into it. And that's kind of how I see it being both together and distinct. Like it has its own, each piece has its own part. But I think within, you know, our lived experience, it can be very hard to distinguish. Like in coaching, a lot of times what will happen is when you're breaking down a belief, let's say that you come to me, Reese, and you're like, I really want to be successful, but I just don't know if I don't know if I can. I don't know if I'm ready. I don't know if I'm capable. Is that a thought or is that an emotion? It's both. And you've got to break them both down. Like in that thought, you have a thought there, and that thought might be, I'm not good enough. I don't have enough experience. You know, I don't know what good looks like. It may be that, right? But the emotion is I'm afraid, or I am concerned, and they blend together to create our reality. And so they aren't separate. They are distinct. But they are all connected. And I think that's part of, you know, I love distinctions. I talk about paradoxes explored. Like I love understanding distinctions, but also the connectivity between things. And I think the more we can understand how this is complexity, you know, it's that they are their own things. And I talk about like one of the ways we can kind of know which part is through the language it uses. So our minds use the language of thoughts. Like that's, we have thoughts are come from the mind. Our hearts, the emotion, it's all there. It's all in the way we feel. Our bodies are action, and our innate self is in being and connection. And so that can also help us understand some of the distinction a little bit as we get into, you know, trying to unpack ourselves.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's super helpful. I love the orchestra analogy, because there is something that kind of arises out of it that is separate from all of these pieces, right? That it comes together to create something. Talk to me a little bit about why you are so fascinated with these questions. What is it about the big questions that called you to write a book about it, right? And help other people with these questions and continue to chase it down, even though, you know, as we've been talking about throughout this conversation, it kind of evades answering, but there's something, I mean, don't let me project anything, but I would imagine there's something to you that still feels worth asking and why that asking is so important to you.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to like, why did I write the book? Part of the reason I wrote the book is because I see the moment we're in culturally, and I think we're struggling with asking the big questions around meaning and purpose. And this generationally breaks down a little bit. Like, I know that like our Gen Z and alphas are coming in and asking more of the why, which is great. But we haven't created really good social mechanisms to talk about these things. And so what I have found is that people will avoid talking about this because there isn't a social mechanism. And so we're very comfortable now talking about our thinking. We're comfortable talking about our emotions. Emotional intelligence has like risen over the last 40 years. So we've gotten very comfortable with that. We've even got more comfortable talking about somatic things, right? Like where we hold tension in our body and what that might mean. What we haven't been comfortable talking about is the spiritual aspect, not culturally, not socially. And it's, to me, such a missing part of the conversation. And it shouldn't just be left for church. And it shouldn't just be left for, you know, mindfulness practices. It really should be a part of how we think about ourselves, how we understand ourselves, because it's a human, like, core characteristic. And so for me, like, being able to create a framework that makes something pretty intangible, maybe a little scary for people, a little bit more grounded to say like, okay, let's think about our higher nature as 8 characteristics. How can we look at each one of these characteristics and just build a muscle? And that, it makes it more tangible. And I hope it also helps break down the fear we might have around engaging with a belief system. And that's not to say that there's beautiful, beautiful things about having a belief system. And I have a belief system. It's not about that. It's about this is the mind versus the being or the spirit dichotomy to me, is if you aren't able to engage with your being because your mind says, I don't know what I believe, you've gotten it backwards. You have to engage with your being, and out of engaging with that spiritual part of yourself, you determine your belief system. And so I want to lower the barrier that people have towards engaging and understanding this piece of themselves, because they think they have to know before they've even sat with it. And that to me is so key, because we are struggling with, and I talk at the very beginning of the book, like, I think we're a lot of what we're calling mental, a mental well-being issue. Not to say there aren't mental well-being issues, there 100% are, and our thoughts do drive us crazy. But I think we are living with some spiritual crisis in our society. And so if there's a way that I can contribute to helping people understand that better about themselves and engage with it in a very grounded way, then like, that's the calling for me.
Yeah, no, I absolutely hear that. And I so appreciate the way that it is about bringing it tangible, because I do think that is the missing piece, is so much of quote unquote spiritual work is that automatically there is a large portion of the population that are just going to have a barrier to entry there. You hear the word spirit or spiritual and it's like, nope. It's like, whether they are a materialist or a naturalist or view themselves as an atheist, it's automatically this no. But I talk about a lot how I'm like, atheists still get a feeling when they hug their mom, right? When they take the first bite of their favorite meal, when they hear their favorite song. And it's like, maybe you don't consider it this immaterial thing, but there is still a mystery there. Talk to me a little bit about that. And in working with this intersection between, I guess I'll just say like materialism and like strict logic. And I don't know if you've had any firsthand experience with like coaching people who that's kind of the framework they start with, but bridging the gap for people who have that automatic like nope to this kind of esoteric work, and making it work for them in a way that isn't shutting down their worldview either, and how this can still be applicable in that world.
Yeah. So I think about what you're talking about, what I'll call like openness to spirituality, I think lives on a spectrum. And my book is probably not for the people who sit on the very far left side of, I don't believe in anything. I think, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is to create space for those who are seeking, who are like, okay, I know there's more to life. I know there's more to me. I don't know how to engage with that. Like, I don't know why I always feel this feeling of like, what's the meaning in it? Or what's the purpose? And how do I engage with those questions in a way that opens me up and doesn't freak my mind out? And I just shut down and I'm super scared, right? And so to me, you know, and I talk a little bit at the beginning of the book, like, part of what I wanted to do here is to create space outside of ideology. Like, to me, like I said, I have a belief system. So there is 100% like that is a very important part of my life. But regardless of what your beliefs are, you have a spiritual aspect of yourself. And it doesn't, and I don't want people to think that beliefs is the entry to understanding the spirit. It is, and I don't even like to use the word the spirit because I think it turns some people off, right? The innate self. The innate self, and let's just talk about it as the characteristics. Like, who disagrees with wanting to contribute? Anybody disagree with that? Like, you don't want to contribute. You don't want to make an impact. You don't want to use your gifts. Right. Like, it's hard to argue that because I have yet to encounter someone who doesn't want to make an impact in some form or fashion. And that can be very material, you know, literally, and very grounded. And like a lot of my coaching with leaders, that's one of the characteristics. One of the other characteristics is around character. Like, what do you want your character to be? This one may be a little bit more personal and deep around like, what are your values? How do you think about your moral code? How do you want to handle ethical moments where it's not clearly black or white, and how, and why does that matter? Like, why does it matter to have a strong character, or does it matter to you to have a strong character? But I think this is like one of the things, if we start to look at people we admire in life, it's hard to admire someone that we don't admire their character. And so what is it about character that matters to us? Well, character builds trust. Like, if I know that you have a strong value system, and I know what you stand for, and I know what you stand against, I can put more trust in you. And that helps build more societal trust, more trust, you know, together. And again, those things can be shared experiences. They don't even have to be ideological. But there is an ideological component in understanding your own values system. So these are the kind of characteristics of that innate self. Like, courage is one of them. Like, who doesn't want to be courageous? But how do we build the muscle of courage? And what's the difference between courage and bravery? And I talk a little bit about that in the book, because I do think there's a distinction. And part of, Reese, why, like, I think it's good to engage outside of the big conceptual thing. Let's engage with the individual muscles of the innate self, or levers of the innate self, because it's much more grounded to have a conversation about what's the kind of character you want, or what's the kind of contribution you want, or where do you want to be more creative in your life? And all of these pieces together create your higher nature, the things that long for more meaning and purpose and joy and contribution. And that's hard to deny, because it's not an ideology. It's not a belief system I'm asking, you know, people to like get on board with. It's like, let's unpack part of what you want. And it's for those who are seeking that.
Yeah, the things you already know to be true, you already feel to be true. Let's describe it and I'll just repeat exactly what you said. Unpack it a little bit to unmystify the things that we all know and feel. I love that. And
just on that point, like what and that is a part for me is recognize these things you already feel. And do and question, that is the innate self. We just haven't had a name for it. We haven't tied these things together. We haven't seen that this is what it means to have the more spiritual aspect of yourself. But longing for meaning is an inherently more spiritual thing. Like, why do we long for meaning? There's something in us that longs for purpose. And so like, let's acknowledge that and let's put a name to that and let's understand how that works in our lives. And let's not be afraid of the big questions. You know, let's engage with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's so powerful. And I also think that a lot of what you're talking about here and part of what's so powerful about the book is the way that it does ground it back into our reality. And, you know, at the very beginning, you talked about your work with refugees, which is a big thing throughout the book. And personally, I don't think that it's a coincidence that we are experiencing this like massive global shift feeling, right? Towards an eye towards meaning, like the meaning crisis that all of the people are talking about is happening at the same time of a lot of political, social, and environmental unrest. That seems like
meaningful.
It seems meaningful. Yeah, I can make meaning of that, right? Why is this work? Because I think so often in work that is about justice or really grounded in this reality, right? It's kind of dissected from the innate self because it feels separate and different, even though it's absolutely not. They're so intertwined. And we can see how like a lot of religious organizations have these aspects of charity and service as these very integral pieces of them for all of the good and bad that organized religion brings. Talk to me a little bit about your work in bringing the innate self into this lived reality and how that helps inform your work of making this life, whether or not, you know, your belief system calls for a second one or an afterlife or all of the personal questions, but how does it inform making this iteration of the innate self a good one, a just one, one that does contribute to the other people around us in a healthy, loving way?
Yeah, I mean, another big question. So the way I unpack what you just asked is if I think about, so humans are really interesting beings because on the one hand, we're incredibly selfish. Like we're kind of wired to get what we need, right? We just kind of go after those primal things, but there's a reason we call those primal. And then we have other things, things that are not primal, that are about contributing, that are about helping other people. And those are more divine things. I don't know a better language for it than those are things that flow out of something bigger than us that we have inside of us. And that I encompass in the innate self. And I think, gosh, isn't the world better if we're all giving a little, if we're a little bit kinder to one another, if we're a little bit more generous to one another? And your first question just around like you were having sort of a meaning moment, a meaning crisis moment at the same time that we have all this social, political unrest. I think it's a really important point because to me, and this is probably why, you know, the book was like waking me up at 4 a.m. to like, you got to write this book, you got to get this out. Because to me, it's a wake up call moment. Like we all need to have this, hey, just going after our own primal needs and making sure I get everything I need, and filling my own cup but not caring about your cup isn't working for us. It's destroying nature. It's destroying each other. We're not happier. We're not. We're more anxious. We're lonelier. Let's wake up and recognize that that's a very primal way of living. And when we live that way, it's not very like fulfilling. It may be satisfying our short-term kind of dopamine like hit needs, but it's not bringing more joy. It's not bringing more fulfillment. And so we need to ask a different question. We need to look at life a little differently. And to me, that's why the timing of like understanding our innate self is so imperative, because we all have the answer inside of us. It's just about getting out of all of our patterns and our thinking. And you know, when I was back in like seventh grade in middle school, we talked a lot about self-esteem. I don't know if the kids are talking about self-esteem these days, but like one of the things when you were being taught on self-esteem is it's more blessed to give than to, you know, to receive. And that's a part of how we actually see ourselves as better beings, is by contributing to other people. And if you've ever done it, you know it, you feel it. It's like, wow, this is so much more powerful than if I was just doing what feels good to me. And that's part of what I feel like was life-changing about working with the refugee community, is that, you know, I worked with people who, you know, literally had fled for fear of persecution and death and had lived in tents for 40 years. And they would show up in my classroom, just the most joyful people I had ever met. They radiated peace and love, and their energy was just incredible. And their energy was contagious. It changed me. And I was there to contribute to them, but they gave me so much more than I gave them just by their gratitude and their generosity. Like, I can't tell you how many of my refugees would bring me gifts, and they literally had probably $100 a month to spend on stuff like that. And they were choosing to spend it. And how does that not make you feel so much more connected to people when you see that they're giving just the little bit that they have and they're sharing it with you? It softens you. It softens your heart. And I think we all need to practice a little bit of that, a little bit of softening. We've been very hard, and I think that's one of the things the mind's good at, is sort of protecting and being sharp. And that's where some of those ideological, you know, differences, the political breakdowns that we're having, I don't know that it's serving us. And so the way out to me is, let's tap into that softer compass guide in ourselves that does want to give, that does want to contribute. And let's see if that isn't a better way of living.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and I think, like you said, like, let's see, because clearly this isn't working, you know, and I think that is something that we can all feel, is like, there is something's got to give. In writing this book, you know, you mentioned earlier, your book is not for the people all the way on the one end of the spiritual spectrum that are like, not ready, or just like, not closed. Yes, the nope, right? Which is a completely valid place to work from. I don't want this to come across as judgmental or anything like that towards people that have that nope. I think that that's just a different avenue of accessing the mystery, right? But in terms of this kind of work, I feel as though there may also be another spectrum of people who are really open to like, yes, let's tap into the softness. Yes, let's tap into the kindness. Yes, like, we all need to turn an eye towards that. And the people that are, nope, it's a dog eat dog world. You know, you have to look out for yourself first. You need to, like, the whole grind set culture thing, right? That's the whole thing. How do you approach that spectrum with your work, in the sense, I think, yeah, and where do you see it meeting that,
yeah,
need?
You know, I would say let's start from where we align, and we can all find something to align on. So let's just take Harry Potter, shall we? Because Harry Potter was huge and everybody read Harry Potter. And I haven't met a single person, no matter what their belief system, that was like, go Voldemort. I really want the bad guy to win. You know, it's like, it just, everybody rooted for the light. And that's, I think, where we start, is who doesn't want to root for the goodness and the light? Like, who's really on the side of Darth Vader? And like, we share that. That's one of those common threads of humanity, is like, we root for the light. We have hope in us. It's just how we're made. And so I think if we can start from a place of groundedness, and like, we all want life to be better, right? And we all want goodness to win, right? And we don't want to live in a world of corruption, right? Like, I think we can ground on some of those things. Again, I am not trying to push ideology. To me, it's about,
right,
let's find that seed of the self that looks for beauty, that looks for light, that looks for goodness. And let's nurture that seed. And so if you may have a full blown tree in there that's like soaking up the light and, you know, producing fruit, you may have a little tiny seed that just needs some watering and that needs to explore. And so that's why I call it a spectrum. But I think regardless of, again, part of what you're raising is kind of our belief system. Let's step outside of that and let's look at like where we all want goodness and light and love. Like, who doesn't want to be loved? I haven't met that person yet. And so if we start with those things, you've already tapped into the innate self. Now, how open you are to it or not, that's 100% on every single person. Like, to how big do you want that to be in your life or not? But if we can tap into it, if we can just recognize it, that's even a huge start to me.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think almost it's how you say, how you hear all the time, like, recognition is the first step, or like, awareness is, it's like 90% of it too, right? Is that it's like just calling something to awareness and looking at something, right, is kind of a lot of what we're talking about. I do want to read one of the quotes that you include in the book. You have several epigraphs throughout, and I love it. I'm such a quotes person. When I was little, I had a gallery wall in my room that was just filled with all sorts of quotes. There's always something beautiful to me about kind of capturing the thing that we're talking about, right? And this one I had never heard before. And it just really, really struck me. And it's an Albert Einstein quote. And so I'll read it for our listeners. A human being is a part of the whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty.
Right?
And that's Albert Einstein. The most analytical, like, left brain guy we know, right? Like, the space-time continuum talking here about compassion and consciousness.
But I think, I mean, to that point, though, and this is why I thought it was so powerful, like, if it's good enough for Albert Einstein, I mean, come on, like, it's good enough for me. But I think there's something so powerful about that Albert Einstein, to me, really represents kind of the beauty of the whole. He was highly analytical. He was very intelligent. He understood science incredibly well. And yet he held within that same construct, the mystery, intuition. He talks a ton about intuition. And he understood this kind of more esoteric nature of life. And without fully getting it, like, it's just right. I see this and I see that we're segmented from it, and let's understand and try to build more collective wholeness towards it. And oh, I just, I mean, that's so powerful. Yeah, it's so powerful to me that he sort of represents that whole. But, you know, I think you said something at the very beginning about New Age versus kind of ancient. And I tend to lean more towards the ancient as well in terms of how I think about this, because I feel like it's a we've just kind of lost an ancient secret on some of this stuff that if you go back and you read Plato and Socrates, and I talk a little bit about that at the very beginning, like we've been wrestling with the nature of man since forever. And let's go back and look at how they talked about some of these things. And so Albert has a great quote there, but one of the things that the allegory of the cave, have you heard the allegory of the cave? Right. Such a beautiful analogy for those who haven't heard that story. I'm going to do my best at summarizing it, but it's essentially there are these people who are living in this cave and they've never seen light. And they're chained to this, to the wall, and they're only able to see the shadows of themselves on the wall. And they think that that's reality because that's all they've ever seen. And at the end of the allegory, you know, they're freed and they walk into the light and they're totally blind. And I think that is such a beautiful way of understanding kind of this piece of us that we may not fully understand it. We may feel blinded by it, or some of this may feel like too hard to conceptualize, but like, let's get out of just looking at the shadows and let's step into the light. Let's look at how expansive we can be. You know, humans are not just primal. We are also divine. And so stepping into the like understanding that we are more than those things. And that's why we ask the big questions.
Yeah.
And not just the big questions. Like I talk about meaning is like micro meaning versus macro meaning. We make meaning, Reese, out of everything. Like
everything.
The look that you have on your face right now, I'm making meaning out of that. The smirk that your mom had on the phone last night when she like, you know, we make meaning out of all of that. And so it's just so important to recognize like we are meaning makers. We can make good meaning. We can make bad meaning. But let's lean into it. Let's not shy away from it.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I mean, clearly the podcast is called Making Meaning.
I know.
You are absolutely yes. If any listeners are curious about Plato's allegory of the cave, I'll link some resources down below too, so that you can dive in and explore
make
that
your own
bit
meaning.
More. Make yes. your own meaning out of it. Exactly. But the piece, the meaning that I always make that, well, not always, because I think, you know, you first read it in whenever I did and it's like, oh, this is so powerful and you have all these gut reactions. But in returning to it, the piece that really sticks out to me now is that they're blind when they leave the cave and they see the sun. And I think your note of human beings being both divine and earthly, like we kind of sit at the crux of that, right, is taken so well. And there is something about like staring straight into the sun will burn your retinas, right? It will literally harm you. And in Greek mythology, you can't be in the presence of a god, otherwise you will be burned up. And there's something, I think, hubristic about wanting to be fully divine, because mm-hmm. that does ignore the earthly, the body of it all, right? And yet we have ignored a lot of the light too, and that it is the combination of these things that is our special mix of humanity. How do you conceptualize of that special kind of blend, and what makes the human experience of the divine distinct?
You know, I think of, if I think about religion just in its most like basic objective, I think it's to conquer the primal, like in the most basic form, regardless of the religion, it's basically like recognize that you have these things in you, that if you feed those, I love the story, the Native American story about the two wolves in the stomach. Do you know this, the story, right? So it's the story goes, this grandfather's telling his grandson, you know, about there's two wolves that live inside of you. There's a good wolf and a bad wolf. And the grandson says, well, which wolf wins? And the grandfather says, the wolf you feed. And I think that's it, right? So religion is a mechanism to help us feed the good wolf. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, depending on how people weaponize it. I think there is something so important about having faith in something bigger than yourself. I think it helps us feed the good wolf, because if you just stay attached to you and to, am I making enough money? Am I happy? Am I doing what I want to do? It can feed that more primal, it's a wolf. It wants to eat all the time. It wants to eat everything in its path, right? Whereas the other side is that, which I would talk about as the innate self, is it wants to give, it wants to share. It sees goodness in everyone, or goodness in opportunity, like around us. It gets outside of some of the selfishness. And you have to feed that wolf, because we do have that primal side, and we do have the other. So recognizing the duality within us, it's the light and dark in Harry, because we talked about Harry Potter, right? And I think it's in every major story. Like, it's also in Lord of the Rings, when Frodo's having this moment in the cave and he's like, I don't know. And what does Gandalf say to him? He's like, it's not about being all good. It's about being more good than you are bad. And I think there's just something, I butchered that, but you get the point. That's not a direct quote, but it's, but I think there's something so important for us to recognize in the duality of our being, but that we have to feed the good wolf. And if we're not intentional, then it's very easy to lose sight of that, and to just lean into our, you know, our selfish kind of more primal nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do love your examples of Frodo and Harry and, you know, we could also Luke and no, I absolutely same. And I think there's a reason why these things are so popular, is because it speaks to something that it's hard to put into words, right? And yeah, it's so beautiful. For you, in your journey towards feeding the good wolf and this idea of giving back, and you know, you said you were woken up at 4 a.m. like, you got to get this out, you got to write it down. And may we all have the blessing and the curse of something waking us up at 4 a.m. to just have to do it, right? What has this meant to you? And in where you currently are on your journey with your innate self, I guess just talk to me about where you are right now in your journey with your innate self.
Yes. Yeah, so a great question. I think, you know, for me, writing this book was an exercise in a few things. One, it was an exercise in faith. It was like, okay, this is something I feel called to do. I'm going to do it, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm just going to do it, and I'm going to release control a little bit, and I'm going to hope that it adds value to people's lives. That was something very growing for me in my own kind of practice. And the other piece of that was discipline. It takes a lot to write a book. And I'm an executive. And I also have a 2.5-year-old kid. And so carving out the time, that's why the 4 a.m. wake up call probably, I had to be very disciplined about it. And you know, we don't talk a lot about discipline as a culture, except for if you're kind of into Stoicism. But discipline, I think, is such an important muscle of feeding the good wolf, in the sense that you have to conquer the primal. Like, you can't just, it's so easy to just roll over and push the snooze button because your body wants to sleep. But to choose to get up and to do the hard thing, which is what it was for me, which is get up, do the hard thing, go get myself a cup of coffee, sit down, write for a couple of hours before I start my work day, be tired. It's okay. Like, I'm choosing to do this because I think it's meaningful to do this. And it's an exercise in in the muscles of self-discipline. And that was a very like personally growing lesson for me. I'm not always so great at self-discipline. So it's really been a good reminder to me of the power and the importance of it. And again, something that we don't necessarily talk about so much culturally. So very growing in that way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're so right about that kind of, I think so often in the spaces that we do see discipline talked about, it's actually also maligned sometimes in, like, there's been a really big push towards stoicism in like manosphere spaces that I think it can get really toxic and has turned into something that I'm like, that's not the stoicism that I read. Interesting. I mean, the way we all make meaning, right? Interesting to see the way that meaning has been made there. But I really love what you're saying about it being a tool we can use. And it's a great reminder of how all of these things are tools, and what we do with them is how it feeds the different wolves. I want to be please.
Well, the last thing I'll just say on this about, you know, I think as I was writing it, the one chapter that was the hardest for me was to writing the character chapter. And it was so hard because I think we don't talk a lot about character as a culture. And so I had to really wrestle with like the concept and like what makes up our character and how do you think about it? And I had to go back to good old Benjamin Franklin and some of, you know, going backwards a little bit to look and reflect on, to kind of a Jane Austen like note to talk about one's character, you know, and it caused me a lot of reflection on like, do I live with the kind of character I want to live with on a day-to-day basis? And that is the beauty to me of engaging with the innate self, is its pause, its reflection, and its intentionality. And like, don't we all want to live with a little bit more intentionality, you know, in who we are and how we show up and how we engage in life? And so in that way, it was also very, very growing for me on my innate self.
No, that's beautiful. And I think too, like the best books are the ones that you can tell are also for the author, that like, it's not just this thing that they kind of pulled out of nothing, but it's like, it's your innate self is imbued in it. And I think as a reader, at least for me as a reader, I could certainly feel that. And it's that energy is it's not lost in the words. To be mindful of our time here, I want to take us into, I have a final two questions that I ask all my guests. One is, of course, we will have everything, links to Jules and her work and the book and all of the good stuff. Please, please, please go read The Innate Self. Check out Jules's work. It will all be linked in the description box wherever you are listening or watching to this episode. But in light of our conversation and all of the things we talked about, is there anything you would like to go back to, clarify, underline, anything we didn't get to, anything I missed, anything that you think we need to have? This is space for you to go anywhere that you think we need to go.
I mean, we covered quite a bit and we got pretty deep. I think one thing we didn't talk about that that I do talk about in the book is just the lightheartedness that I think is also in our innate self, and the fun we need to bring to the space. You know, sometimes we engage with this with heaviness, like, oh my gosh, everything you just said sounds so hard and it's so heavy. And we, you know, as grownups, we tell ourselves to like grow up and not, you know, be so silly and maybe have so much fun. And I really challenge that. I think that so much of what this part of us can embody is lightness and fun and joy. And I think we all can step into that a little bit. So, you know, I talk a little bit about finding your funny bone, in the book. And I just think there's something like, as you engage with this, it's, you know, one of the things I tried to do is add a little humor as I wrote the book, so it didn't feel so heavy and staunch. And I just think it's important to maybe say that, that there is space to engage with this lightheartedly.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for adding that. I think play is so important, and stepping into it's like inner child stuff, but also there's an Alan Watts quote, back to the quotes, that I love, that is, if we're not supposed to dance, then why all this music? Which yes. speaks really beautifully to your orchestra analogy, but I completely agree in that if the point of this is to live meaningfully, it's like we don't want to live meaningfully with a storm cloud over our head, right? And it's like some of the most spiritual moments of my life are sitting around a dining table with my best friends laughing, right? Mm-hmm. Like your stomach hurting. And it's like, that is where I feel God, you know? Mm-hmm. So thank you for bringing that. I think that's super important. My last question that I always like to ask, just to try and put a, some sort of button on the beautiful expansive conversation we've had, what is one word to describe how you're feeling right now?
The word that comes up for me is enchanted. I've been thinking about like one of my favorite words, and that word has been coming up. And the reason I think I love it so much is it's sort of, it's got that fun and mystery together. Is like, how can we have a little bit more enchantment in our day, in our, in who we are and how we show up? And I feel like this conversation has been deep, playful. It's been, expansive. And I think that that, and we've talked a lot about mystery, which, we don't talk about so much in our day, in our daily lives. So.
Right.
So my word would be enchanted.
I absolutely love that. I also love the twinge of magic that it it calls us to feel too. That's really so beautiful. Jules, I cannot thank you enough for your work in this book, for the opportunity to be able to dive into your words, and for your time and energy today. Thank you
so much. My pleasure, Reese. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you all so very much for being here today, and a huge thank you to Jules Kuroda for her work, for the beautiful book, The Innate Self, and for her time and energy during this episode. Again, if you are interested in reading The Innate Self or anything else that Jules does, all of the links to find her and her book and all of that good juicy stuff will be in the description down below, wherever you may be listening or watching. If you are interested in working with me to find or pursue your purpose, head to thecoherecollective.com and click on Coherent Design, which is our unique approach to life coaching, even though I don't really like that word. That's why I call it Coherent Design, to do that and chat about that. And thecoherecollective.com is also where you can find all sorts of other cool stuff that we're doing, other podcasts, other blogs, writings, great things that can help you deepen your work when it comes to coherence. You can follow The Cohere Collective anywhere on social media, all at The Cohere Collective. And there's some other cool content on socials too that you won't be able to find anywhere else. So I highly recommend you check it out. You can also find the creator of Making Meanings art and podcast cover, Nicole O. Stryker, on Instagram at Nicole O. Creates or Nicole O. Design, and the creator of Making Meanings theme music, Tristan Morgan, at Tristan Morgan on Instagram. Again, subscribe, like, 5-star rating, review, comment, let me know your thoughts, let's have a conversation, and let me know, what'd you think of this episode? Do you want more like this? And if you do, I'll have an episode linked at the end of this one that relates, that you'll probably find interesting too if you liked this one. Right now, I am feeling apocalyptic. If you're also a listener of Bow Down, another podcast that we have here at the Cohere Collective, this Friday, I believe, the next episode coming out is going to be kind of about the Uranus moving into Gemini transit that's happening astrologically, but also just the energy that Dennis, my co-host of Bow Down, and I are feeling right now, and what's going on in our personal transformations and work. And one thing that came up for me in that episode is that I'm in my apocalypse era. Everything is kind of being torn down right now, but a la the Tower card in tarot,
when you tear everything down, what is the foundation there? What pearl is at the center of the oyster that we want to harvest and cultivate and gestate to continue growing and creating something out of that? As painful as tower moments are, they're also the biggest inciting moments of change, of growth, of expansion. I was about to say progress, but even that's too linear. It's expansion in all directions, and that's what I'm trying to embody right now. Even with all of the questions that have been coming up for me lately, I have just been in it. I've been in the work, y'all, and it feels good. Kind of like the pain of getting a tattoo. It's like, oh, it hurts, but like it's good pain. It's good pain. Which makes me think of the Yolklore song, Good Pain. It's a good song. If you don't know Yolklore, highly recommend you go check them out. Okay. I believe that's all I have for y'all here. Again, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for being a part of the Cohere Collective, for being my favorite part of Coherence, for being part of my coherence. And as always, I hope you feel like you are living more coherently. Until next time, love.